Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here once a week around our kitchen table in the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Thanks to our supporters, and thanks to you, our listeners, for being with us today. We've got some great things to talk about. Yes, we do. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions.
And weather.
And whatever comes up. This is our show. This is community radio, which means we're mostly all volunteers here, and this is our show. We can talk about just about anything as long as we keep it clean.
Within the limits of moral decency, which are flexible, apparently, these days. However, we'll stick to the tried and true old-fashioned values.
Yes, we will. Today on the Donalana Kitchen, we'll find out about lots of things. Donna will tell us about her weekend road trip, and we'll find out about mushrooms. Mushrooms. We have a special guest in our studio from Joy Grow Farm, Aaron Johnson, and he's going to tell us lots of good things. But first, blueberries. Blueberries. It's the season.
Hallelujah, blueberries.
Blueberries
oh boy.
Are here. What a great invention. You know, somebody designed blueberries to be growing, and they're on these bushes that kind of come up to meet you. You don't have to bend over too far at all, and they're just
picking strawberries, is it?
No, and they don't have thorns.
And it's not like picking blackberries.
And there's, I just picked some last night. There were no mosquitoes because it was a nice night, and those bushes are there. There's a long window of being able to pick them, too.
Yeah, and they don't really have seeds, things, or pits. And they don't have to be hulled. And they don't have to be peeled. And it's the most easy-peasy fruit to cook with or eat. I don't think I have ever met a person that didn't like blueberries.
Right.
If I did, I wouldn't want to know them.
All right.
Yes.
All right. Woo. Anyway, one nice thing about blueberries, they're a little tricky to grow in your home garden. I've tried and failed a couple of times. But the wonderful people that grow blueberries in quantity for U-Pick operations, oh, bless their hearts. And this is obviously a good year. Just last night, I was out picking blueberries at the Berry Patch Farm, south in Nevada, Iowa.
I'm sure they have a website with a map because it is an extraordinary, we're just so lucky to have them in the community.
And they would like to, they said out there, Mike said as I was checking out, he says, be sure to tell folks that we need pickers because we got blueberries and please come on out.
Super, super abundant year. We are in luck. I would say this might be the best news of the week that there's a big, big blueberry harvest to be had this year.
Right, right.
And Judy Henry is the farmer.
Yes, yeah.
Used to run a preschool. So her whole farm is completely kid-friendly. And it's just, if you're looking for an opportunity to educate your young children, and that would be from anybody that can walk all the way through teenagers about where your food grows on bushes. Did you know that?
Or you may want to educate your friends. Grab yourself a car full of people and go out there and say, here's where blueberries come from.
I would say that, you know, in the present moment, this is the year for blueberries. This is the time. And we're kind of excited about this blueberry extravaganza. It doesn't, you know, we don't get a bumper crop every year like this.
Things are looking good.
Yeah.
You can find out more at www.berrypatchfarm.com. Yes.
Oh, and a little word about how many gallons did you pick, Lana?
4.
Okay. Just in case you get overwhelmed and can't eat all those,
I can't eat 4 gallons.
They do hold well in the refrigerator. And you know, if you're taking little kids, you can. There's the old classic books. What was it? Blueberry Picking with Sal, where they run into the mama bear eating berries. And there's another one, Jamberry. They're, you know, kids and blueberries go together. And if you pick a lot, they're really easy to freeze. You just kind of spread them out on a sheet tray or something, put them in the freezer, and then as soon as they're frozen, you can roll them into a bag and whoop, there they go.
And you are set for the winter. There you go. There you go. Blueberries. With us in our studio today is Aaron Johnson. Welcome.
Hi.
I'm glad you could join us today. He is a mushroom grower. I can find mushrooms in the woods every now and then, but there's this man at the Ames Farmers Market.
It's the Mushroom Man.
That has this beautiful display, and he actually grows these things. He grows on a farm called Joy Grow Farm over by Ogden, Iowa.
Joy Grow.
Tell us about your farm. How long have you been into this mushroom thing, Aaron?
And how did you do this?
Well, that's loaded questions. about 3.5 years now. So it just has become a passion of mine, something that I really enjoy doing. But and I have a unique product that not everybody else offers. So there's just a handful of mushroom cultivators in the state, and I'm one of them.
And what kind? So when I see you at the farmer's market, so you're at the Boone Farmer's Market and the Ames Farmer's Market on Saturday morning. What kinds of mushrooms do you usually have?
Yeah, do the Boone Farmer's Market. It's actually on a Thursday from 3 to 6, and then the Ames Farmer's Market, if not everybody knows, is from 8 to 12:30.
Saturdays, yes.
So I have a variety of mushrooms with my workhorse, and the main variety being oyster mushroom. Now, within that genus, there's a lot of different species and strains. I have blue oyster mushrooms, golden oyster mushrooms, pink oyster mushrooms.
Pink?
Yes, pink.
And do you detect flavor differences amongst these varieties?
Yes, there's definitely nuances between them. I would say more of it's a textural thing. So, like, the pinks are less dense, have a little bit more rubberiness or texture to them, whereas the blues have kind of a little chewy stem that some customers really, really crave. The white ones are denser and a little more meaty, and the gold ones are...
And do they retain their colors when you cook them?
That, again, with the pinks actually do kind of turn into a pale pinkish-white. The golden oyster mushrooms actually do retain their color fairly well and stay nice, vibrant yellow. So,
And besides oysters, what else do you grow?
Shiitake, several.
Oh, yum.
Yeah, I love shiitakes.
Shiitakes, I think, have a very, very vibrant flavor. You know, some mushrooms they're kind of subtle. They're really subtle.
Sure.
But shiitakes... You know when you eat a shiitake.
Mm-hmm. And they're one of my favorites, but the turnaround is not quite the same as with oyster mushrooms. So oyster mushrooms, you're looking, variety-wise, anywhere from 3 to 5 weeks before I have a finished product. Mm-hmm. With shiitakes, just incubation alone, they're sitting in my house, or my incubation house, about approximately 110 days.
Oh. Well, they're sitting there developing that flavor, I would
correct,
guess.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So that's why they have less of those on hand at any given moment. It's just, you know, it's a time and space issue. But the oysters they're a beautiful mushroom. They're really versatile, good universal mushroom. I'd use them in any way that you'd use like a button mushroom, but better flavor, better texture.
And earlier in the year, I saw some shapes and forms of mushrooms that I hadn't seen
before.
Yeah,
you're probably thinking of like the hirsutum, so like the lion's mane.
Oh, I was just about to ask you about lion's mane.
And coral tooth.
See, I'd never heard
coral tooth.
Do explain.
Sure. So what most people don't understand is that the way that I propagate my mushrooms is through tissue propagation. So there is no sex. It's kind of boring. There's no spores. There's nothing like that. Because
no spores.
So with spores, you actually have sexual reproduction, and you get the crossing of gametes, and then that's where you develop different strains. And so what I'm growing is isolates. They're pure monoculture that have already been been tested for fruit and capability.
So you can predict what you're going to harvest.
Correct.
Basically.
But also in the same sense, I have two mushrooms right now that I'm running in my room that were wild here in Iowa, local strains that I went out to the woods and I did a tissue propagation and have been, you know, doing my fruiting trials, and now I have them in production.
Okay. Does this mean you had to study mycology somewhere, somehow?
No.
tissue propagation.
Sure.
This is pretty technical stuff.
I was a biology major at Iowa State, and that has a little help. It wasn't necessarily focused on mycology, but it has fascinated me, and I took a few classes. Some of it, you know, just kind of goes hand in hand, too, with – I was amazed how much brewing beer and growing mushrooms is similar.
Oh, so you brew beer now?
No, I don't have time for that. I just buy beer.
There's plenty of good ones around.
Boone Valley Brewery, I'm going to drop that. They have excellent beer.
But actually, that's a good transition from beer to mushroom. Oh, you're dealing with amazing things. I have visions in my head about what your farm looks like. I can either see there's this amazingly clean and very techno, high-tech lab, or there is this elfin glade with little fairies and violets all everywhere. I don't know.
Often be. Always.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So tell me about
how do you do this?
How this happens?
It's a two-part operation. So I'm a small mom pops, you know, grower, and someday I plan on getting a little bit bigger and having a little more room. But I have my lab actually in my garage, which is dedicated for mushroom cultivation and storage dry goods. I don't park a car in there anymore. and then within that lab, I have a flow hood. And so what that does is pushes purified air across my workstation so I can work in a sterile environment.
Ah. Oh, right. This is technical stuff, but yeah.
And so that's kind of where the story begins, is in my lab. That's where I'm doing my tissue propagation.
The mad scientist mushroom grower.
Well, it's really not that crazy or adventurous, but it's something I really enjoy. And
well, it is very creative, actually.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. I mean, not everybody gets excited about looking at a culture on a petri dish and seeing the growth, but I do.
We can get excited about the final product.
Yes, you can. So, like I said, the journey begins in the lab. That's where I do all my inoculations. And then from there, it doesn't matter the species, they all have to incubate. And so I incubate these fully sterilized bags.
This is all indoor?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
So this is all indoors. I sterilize those bags under high pressure and heat, cool them down for a day, bring them to my lab, do my inoculations, and then they have to incubate.
What's the medium that it's growing in?
That is a great question also. So it does depend on the species of varying like supplementation, but it's the majority of the base is hardwood fuel pellets or just sawdust, sawdust.
Oak.
So a lot of these species that I'm growing are saprophytic, or mean they like to live on dead or decaying material, and that's dead wood. That's one of the beauties that you can use these kind of waste products to make food out of. Now, they're supplemented, like I said, just on varying degrees.
Can you grow them on ash tree sawdust? We have a lot of it around here these days.
You know, I've worked with raw sawdust, and it's just a pain. If I can get everything in pelletized form, I will do that.
There you go.
Oh, because it's the heat treatment kills all the things in there that you don't want? Is that why?
Yes. That's why I'm sterilizing. I want, just like brewing beer, when you go to brew beer, you're pasteurizing. Right. You're not sterilizing, but you're trying to set up some perfect little community just for one organism. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you get off flavors with beer, or you get contamination with mushrooms. It goes both ways. So, after incubation.
So it's in a little petri sort of dish?
Well, it depends. There's several different forms of inoculants that you can use for mushroom, and that does fascinate me.
Oh.
You can use liquid inoculants, petri dishes where it's the agar-agars is the base with some kind of sugar, and the same with like liquid cultures that has some kind of sugar. And then from there, you move on up to grain spawn. You use a mix of
what?
Either grain spawn. So if
grain spawn.
Grain spawn. So that is the grain, just like you would use any kind of cereal grain. I use either rye or oats, millet, milo, same as sorghum. So I have to hydrate that.
Uh-huh.
I hydrate it overnight, drain it, and then I process it just like I do all my other bags where I fully sterilize
grain
it.
Grain spun. It's like sprouts, basically?
No, it's just regular,
wet
bag of oats, you know?
Wet stuff.
And it's then that are dry in storage, you know, 50-pound bag, and I hydrate them, and then I sterilize them, and then I use them for my propagation. So it's a good, nutritious home to put the mycelium on or the mushroom tissue. So then I use that grain spawn to inoculate my bulk substrates. Uh-huh. So that would be the larger bags, the stuff that I've supplemented, the hardwood fuel pellets and maybe wheat bran or soybean hulls or alfalfa pellets.
You can use all of those things.
Yeah, you really can. So with the wood, there's not very little nutritional value in it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so what I'm doing is supplementing to increase my yields, increase the quality of the fruit.
So what do you supplement then? What are you using right now?
Like I said, it does depend on the species, but soybean hulls, wheat bran, alfalfa pellets, beet pulps, things like that. Something that's a high protein source,
mm-hmm.
and fiber.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you need to just increase those yields and give them a little happy home.
Amazing things they're looking to grow, and it sounds like you can make them happen. Oh, how good. And you said some the oyster mushrooms have the quickest growing time?
Yeah. Again, like I said, those are my workhorse because they're such a versatile, tasty mushroom,
mm-hmm.
but also are quick growers so that I can keep the lights on and have, you know, a consistent crop every
mm-hmm.
week.
Oh, you,
so
and
if
you
I was
do, and you do. I'm amazed. I look at your stand there, and there's these boxes, and the mushrooms are just blooming out of them. Oh, they're so good. I was amazed.
Yeah.
So how long does it take from the time you put the mushroom, like for the oysters, from the time you put them in the bag of whatever the substrate is?
So, again, that does depend on the strain. But typically, the oysters run fairly quick. Those pink oyster
mushrooms.
Okay,
now what's fairly quick? Are we talking about 4 weeks?
Even faster than that. So, like, those pink oyster mushrooms, from the time that I take that fully sterilized cooled bag to my lab and inoculate it, I can have them starting to pin in 9 to 10 days.
Oh, my.
Whereas, you know, some of the other oyster strains, it might be, it's typically right around 2, 2.5 weeks.
Well, wait, you have to tell us what pin means.
Oh, a pin is a little baby mushroom cap.
Oh, from when you start to, it's like when it emerges,
yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah, yeah, uh-huh. little baby mushroom caps. So you see, we just call them pins, I guess,
that's,
yeah.
That's good.
I forget.
So what does your sort of growing space look like? Give us a little description.
Well, when
it's not your garage.
No, ma'am. It is a dedicated room where I can control my temperature, my mm-hmm. humidity, my air exchange, and then lighting. And yes, they do require light. They do not grow in a cave.
Oh, see, that's a myth.
So tell me square footage. How big are we talking about?
I grow in 100 square feet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
So I was limited in space, but you know what? It's made me really focus on efficiencies
mm-hmm.
and improving the process. Because when I began, it was a sloppy mess with straw. And you can grow a lot of quality.
So what do you have, stacks and racks to get?
I do. I have a racking system.
Uh-huh.
So I have treated lumber with metal conduit pipes that I have spaced apart so they can a bag can just kind of saddle right in between those bars. And I can fit, you know, 20 bags on a rack. So in that 100 square feet, I've made it vastly more efficient by these bags, fully sterilized bags.
Well, just to have to, so you have to control temperature, humidity, and light?
Yes, ma'am. So we need, they actually do, they're phototropic, meaning that they require light. Otherwise, they look all gnarly trying to reach for a light source and it just doesn't give you a quality product.
Is it 24 hours of the day?
No, actually, it's typically 12-12,
mm-hmm.
but I run 14-10. It gives them the caps a little bit more darker, intenser color. So, oh,
okay. By giving it's more, them less light or more light?
More light.
More light.
More
okay,
light.
Okay.
So 14 on, 10 off.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Kind of like pushing a flock of chickens.
Well, I was thinking it is a little bit like it is an incubator of sorts. And then what's the temperature range that they require?
There again, it's a grow year round. So during this time of year, I have to use air conditioning, unfortunately. So I'm constantly playing a battle because I'm exchanging fresh, hot air and my air conditioner running. And so my air conditioner is running pretty much consistently. And I have a fogging unit that is running consistently, too, because mushrooms require a lot of humidity.
Oh.
So if my room isn't at least 85% relative humidity or so, then things start to dry out.
And what's the temperature range you try to keep it at?
Right now, I'm just trying to keep it at room temperature. If I can keep it at 68 degrees, I'm happy with that.
And in the winter, it also has to be 68.
No, then no. The winter is beautiful. I can grow some cold weather mushrooms. I can grow them a lot slower. And it's actually, I think they're a little denser. Not that they aren't beautiful and gorgeous mushrooms now and taste good, but in the summer, winter time, you can go with some nice, a little bit slower growing strains, and I can run it right in the 50s.
Huh. Oh, so. And you said the word better tasting. Describe the difference between summer mushrooms and winter mushrooms.
Right. Well, you can grow, I think, a few more varieties of mushrooms in cooler temperatures because there's not many mushrooms that don't struggle in heat.
But they still take that 85% humidity?
Oh, yeah, they love it.
All right, I'm with the – I like high humidity.
Yeah,
it's a good thing because you have to like it living here in
Iowa. It's funny when I'm outdoors and I notice it's really high humidity, and I, well, in my mind I'm thinking, man, it feels just like my room temperature. Or at least my fogger won't be running hard today.
Yeah, see? Good. The mushrooms like to grab onto a niche area of heat and humidity and go for it. You were talking about your growing mediums. Can you reuse the growing mediums? Or after you're done with a bag of stuff that your mushroom is growing on, what happens to that bag of stuff?
That is a great question. At this point, there is a lot of use for it. But at this point, I have a customer that lives in my town who has a garden full of the most beautiful compost. It makes really, really good compost. And typically I usually get about 2 to 3 flushes or harvest off of a block.
Mm-hmm.
From there, you get diminishing returns with each harvest.
Because it's lost some of its nutrients, right?
Right, exactly. It's eating up that substrate.
Okay. Now, your friend that's using this for compost, does she end up with mushrooms popping up?
Yes, he does have hundreds of little mushrooms that pop up.
Pins.
Yeah. Well, these actually are fully formed mature mushrooms, but they don't get super big. You aren't really, when you're using those compost, to get something to eat because the snails, the bugs, and everything else get to them also first.
Everybody likes a good mushroom.
They do. Yeah. So that is, again, too, with my indoor-grown mushrooms. I have customers who ask me, do I need to wash these? Or no, they're in a nice, clean room on a clean bag. They get harvested with clean hands
culinary
and then right in
note,
a bin.
One should never wash a mushroom.
Right.
They absorb water like quick as
they
a
do.
Bunny. And you – so if you really – if you want to go to the culinary store and you can buy a mushroom brush, but any kind of soft.
You want to hear my theory on button mushrooms, though, with a little bit of – it's actually not dirt, guys. It is casein.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a non-nutritious, just kind of moisture barrier or layer on top.
Yep.
So anyway.
That's that kind of black tobacco-y looking
stuff. Right. My theory is if you're just buying a button mushroom anyway.
Yeah.
And you're going to put it in a dish where there's moisture, just hose it off. It'll be fine.
Oh, wash them. You do.
I do, but I don't. I haven't bought mushrooms in like 3 years. So.
Well, I don't buy them much either,
right.
I must say.
Right. Why
would
I buy
go
them?
The opposite direction. I just throw it in with the stuff on it.
Well,
there's not. By the time you buy them at the grocery store, there's very. You know, you
just. Yeah, they're fairly clean. Yeah.
It's no big deal.
Sure.
It's when you're out collecting them in the wild that you have to work a little bit more.
And
if you've gone to the effort of hunting them out and picking them down, and often it's not easy to find them. You want to get every little bit out of them.
I made that terrible mistake coming back from Canada a few years back. I picked some beautiful apricot chanterelles, and we were kind of in a hurry, and we just threw them in a Ziploc bag, and we didn't pick them carefully, and we got them back. No, they were just, they weren't buggy. They were just covered in sand and dirt. So I tried to crunch through and added butter, but it was not very good.
The chanterelles are hard to clean.
Yeah. If you harvest them nice and clean with a knife and have a little paintbrush, dry paintbrush, that definitely helps.
Oh, just clean as you go.
Yeah.
Good idea.
I harvest it clean, then don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Mushrooms with Aaron Johnson. This is KHOI Community Radio, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are talking mushrooms. And in past Donna Lana shows, we've talked about finding them in the woods, but we have somebody here that has taken it on to be a mushroom grower. Oh, it sounds like he's going great guns. What wonderful things. Aaron Johnson. I have a question, Aaron Johnson. What about, there's this kind of this holy grail. Has anyone figured out how to commercially grow morels?
Oh, man. You tricked me with that question. How did I know that was coming?
I should have expected this.
Right, because you said you're growing some local wild.
It does make me chuckle just because that's one of the first questions that customers ask.
That's the first mushroom, everybody's
fantasy, right?
Right. Well, you know what? They are cultivatable, but in a limited capacity. So there's first a few species that are easier.
What's that mean? They're so limited that if you cultivate them, you eat them all yourself. Like any good morel person, right? These are mine.
Well, there's only a few species that you can actually cultivate. And then within that, you actually have to dedicate a lot of time and space to that one species. Mm-hmm. And the big growers right now are in China, but they're still counting on Mother Nature. So they're building large hoop houses with shade cloths and still growing it outside, and it's a seasonal product. I don't have the time or space
so
to devote to that.
So difficult to cultivate?
Well, they're right there, that you need the capital, the time, and the space. I want more than one crop per year.
Yeah.
I want to crop every week.
Yeah.
So they are beautiful. It's something that it's kind of on the back burner. Although, that being said, I do have a project in the wings for morels. Now, it's one thing to to grow the mushroom mycelium or the tissue, that's relatively easy. It's another thing to actually fruit the mushrooms. So
they're finicky little fellows.
Right. And there again, it may take anywhere from 6 months to a year before you have a finished product.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but here is the deal. Is I've got some Morchella and Portuna, it's something like that, black morels. And I want to start growing that on a organic, non-GMO soybean. So if you've ever heard of tempeh,
it's a
fermented bean soybean product.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I want to hydrate these soybeans and grow the Morchella tissue on that. And now what I've heard from some of my mushroom growing groups is that the taste of morels is, it tastes like morels. So I would absolutely love to offer a product that, you know, that tastes like morels.
Wait, so what are you're growing them on the tempeh-like substance?
So
what
instead
are we talking
of, instead of using the traditional cultures, I believe it's maybe a bacterial culture that they ferment the beans with. And
mm-hmm.
To be perfectly honest, I still got to do a little homework. But I'm going to need to use a morel culture on it. So you'll still have the morel tissue. And, you know, that's an underutilized part of mushroom cultivation that people are kind of waking up about, too. It's innovative to actually eat the mushroom tissue and not the fully developed fruiting bodies.
You mean it'll come out looking like tempeh, but tasting like morels?
It would be more or less analogous to, like, a block of soybeans that are glued together with the mushroom living mushroom tissue.
Oh, for
so you'd be eating a cultured live product.
But when you want to do some culinary trials, you call Lana and I. We will jump right in there with
our
skill set and help you out.
It's probably a few months out yet, but I would definitely keep you in the loop.
Oh my! It sounds like you have a lot of fun doing this.
Yes, there's definitely innovative things, and I'm constantly learning. And if you aren't learning, you're
bored.
Dead. Or bored.
So tell us about your experiments with the wild cultivars, the local.
Yeah, the two that I have right now I would say semi-local, because the Hirschium coralotus, that's my coral tooth mushroom, that is a native to North America species. My wife noticed that this last October, pointed out to me.
Notice it? I mean, she saw
some
somewhere?
Yeah, she saw it. She discovered it. She takes full credit for it.
And you give her full credit,
yes,
right?
Yes, I do. She deserves it.
Okay.
So I found that, or she pointed that out to me.
You mean you were like tromping through the woods and she spotted it?
I was actually doing a mushroom loop, so I was driving slowly in a car looking.
You've got
the car she spotted it?
Oh, yeah.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah. We were going slow. It was actually a McHose bark in Boone.
Huh?
And so I noticed this big, beautiful specimen. I took some small tissue samples, and then I ate all of it myself.
Like any good mushroom person.
Yeah, it was a very large cluster. The other one that I have is from a gentleman that's a good customer of mine and friend. I'll drop the name if you're listening, Kevin Holst. How you doing, buddy? He got some golden oyster mushrooms. Now, those aren't a North American native. They are an escapee from Asia. But they're pretty well naturalized now. So if you go in the woods, they're fairly easy to find and identify. Now, the culture that I got from him is just an outstanding culture. They run quick, meaning they go through the growth medium quick, and they are good yielding and delicious.
Uh-huh.
And pretty.
Yeah.
Very good. Talk about how you learn this sort of stuff. There was a name dropped earlier, a guru.
Oh, yeah. I asked about Paul Stamets, who is, oh boy, I have to say maybe 30 years ago I first heard him lecture, and he talked about the fungal network that pervades the whole planet, and it was pretty interesting work.
He is a mycological rock star and, a genius. He's a very, very intelligent human being.
Has numerous books if you want to read up more on these subjects. In fact, in Michael Pollan's new book, How to Change Your Mind, which is on some of the psychoactive possibilities in certain mushrooms, he has an extensive writing about an interview in Time with Paul Stamets. And there's Paul Stamets really – he has a whole line of medicinal mushrooms and has pioneered a lot of that and people's awareness of the nutrition and – I mean, mushrooms are – there's many, many kinds, but they do a lot of different things. They're quite good for you.
Right. The line is really blurred between gourmet and medicinal.
Mm-hmm.
So
– as it should be.
Right, right. And, you know, in general rule of thumb, whole foods are going to be better for you. So with my mushrooms, I don't claim a lot of health benefits that I don't know, but I do know that they are a good source of
– you look pretty healthy to me.
I do eat a lot of mushrooms. But they are a good source of protein. Some of my oyster mushrooms are as high as up to 25% protein by dry weight. Good sources of B vitamins and vitamin D. And my customers that ask, you know, about the health benefits, and I'll give them some little tidbits that I do know. But it comes from the heart. They just taste dang good. So
And it's true. And if you want to know more about medicinal benefits, there's plenty of information, including Paul Stamets.
Can either of you spell that man's name?
S-T-A-M-E-T-S. Might be double T.
Yeah.
Anyway, Fungi Perfecti is what he calls his company, Fungiperfecti, probably.
Sounds close.
And you can, if you want to know more, he's got a lot out there available. There's books.
Well, he does some TED Talks and a few things. He's done some interviews with Joe Rogan. And so it's very fascinating, fun to listen to.
He's quite a character.
And I picked up on some of my first first cultivation books that he had written. Now at this point they aren't as much help, but it was just a good little base and definitely has some good information in there that is poignant still.
Oh, now you also sell the mushroom kits?
I do. So that's
so tell us about that. This is another good do-it-yourself thing, especially for children, if you want to.
Yes, certainly. They are a great educational
tool. It's
like
catching butterflies from cocoons and things
like
that.
Right, because not only do you get to grow something right on your countertop, but then you get to consume it and use it. So what I do is I make a few extra production blocks. That would be the blocks that I use just for my normal weekly crop.
Mm-hmm.
And I make them – or just label them and use them as kits. So you're going to get
Exactly the thing that you grow in your warehouse.
But a larger than typical kit than you would find online. Online for comparable price, you're going to get a little bit more, and they're going to be, a quarter of the size. You're looking at about
a six and a half pound
block. You'll get anywhere from about pound and a half on your first flush. 3/4 of a pound to a pound on your second with, diminishing turns, like I said earlier. So as you keep on going. So
plus, you get to control the light, the humidity, and the temperature, right?
Right. Now, they're definitely going to grow best in my room under those controlled conditions. But the oysters do allow a little bit of flexibility if you give them a little bit of TLC. So what I do recommend to my customers is just have a water bottle on hand, and as you walk by, give them a little bit of mist, and really that's about it. I've taken a lot of the hard work out of it. Just keep them.
Well, fortunately here in Ames, we have a relatively high humidity all the time.
But if you're going to be in your kitchen countertop with the AC running, they're going to dry out. So
don't put them near the wood stove. Don't put them near the air conditioner, and don't put them in direct sunlight, right?
Yes, correct. You don't want them right in direct sunlight.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Well, I think people are coming to understand that there's a lot more mushrooms than just those buttony things that you can get that they used to be the only thing in grocery stores. There are so many varieties now.
Yeah, you'll like them more if you try other kinds because, frankly, the button ones are a little bit boring.
They are. They kind of can tend to be mealy and watery.
And not a lot of flavor.
I grew up on button mushrooms, though.
Me too, or Campbell's cream of mushroom soup. I mean.
And you go out to the less than reputable restaurants that don't have my mushrooms. And I'll eat them anyway.
Tell us where we can eat, what restaurants are using your mushrooms.
Sure, definitely. With some of the more regular customers that I have here, like Aunt Maud's.
Okay.
Excellent food. TikTok and Boone. Okay. Victor is doing really great things over there. Excellent customer service and really tasty food. The cafe and provisions to a lesser extent. I've been selling to them on and off.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? Barlatoska a few times. Mm-hmm. Old Main has been buying them now regularly too. So I imagine if you wanted to get a burger with some local mushrooms on or something like that. Local brew, then that would mm-hmm. be the place to go.
Okay.
Very good. We can taste all kinds of mushrooms all the time.
Oh, hey, I don't want to forget Mitch and Giangelo's North Ames. He's making really, really good stuff with my mushrooms.
Oh, who's this? D'Angelo's, okay.
D'Angelo's in North Ames.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. He's actually doing some really good stuff with my mushrooms. And he's under remodeling. He's got a new kitchen going in or new dining area. So I'm really excited what he's doing over there.
Great. What a nice opportunity.
And what's your favorite way to cook them?
You know what? They can be really the star of the show with a little bit of butter, olive oil.
That's what I was going to
say.
Butter!
Yep. You can do a flash in the pan for a minute and a half and have them kind of soft, or you can just go a little bit longer until they get nice and crispy, and that's how the kids love them.
Yeah.
But they're also, again, a very versatile, really nice product. Anything you'd use with a button mushroom?
It's true. You can put them in omelets. You mm-hmm. can, well, or you can even, like, partially saute them just till they're nice and soft, and just put a little, not overpowering herbs, depending on the mm-hmm. mushroom, but and a tiny bit of vinegar, and you've got a little antipasto to put with bread or anything like that.
I don't suppose I thought of that one, but I'm always willing
easy
to.
Easy peasy.
Yeah, yeah. I like
yep.
to cook.
Yep.
So.
Well, now I'm hungry. Oh, my goodness. Well, we've been talking with Aaron Johnson from Joy Grow Farm. He does mushrooms. Thank you for being with us today. Can you give your contact information for those of us who would need to find out more?
Sure. So I don't have a traditional website, but what I do have, if you have any Facebook account, go ahead and look for at Joy Grow in the search function.
Great pictures, by the way.
Thank you. They are pretty.
Very good. Joy Grow, Aaron Johnson.
And at the farmer's market in both Ames and Boone.
Thank you for being with us today. This is KHOI, the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen, KHOIFM.org. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more at KHOIFM.org, the Donna Lana Kitchen. We have archives if you go to our webpage there, and we have a bunch of recipes thanks to Gio Chalatse, one of the wonderful volunteers around here that keeps our webpage up to snuff when, just like us, when we get around to it, we will do that.
We need some help from our friends.
Yes, we do. Which I remind you that this is a volunteer-driven radio station. So, you have an opportunity to help, too. All right. Donna, talk about your road trip to Nebraska this past weekend.
Oh, I had a lovely drive to, I think it's Marquette, Nebraska, a farm, the David Fetter and his family have been farming organically since organic farming was possible. And so they have an enterprise on their farm called the Grain Place, which is essentially, here's the thing. If you're growing grains in the Midwest, We only have processing ability at this point for corn and soybean. So if you're like an organic farmer and you have to grow a rotation that at the very least includes corn, soy, and then a third small grain, this is to promote soil fertility and to increase diversity so that you don't have the same pest pressures and the same weed pressures, because both the weeds and the bugs, if you're growing the same thing in a monocrop all the time, they just go crazy. So one of the ways that organic farmers break these cycles so that they don't use pesticides and they manage the bugs, one of the ways they do this is by not growing the same thing all the time. And that also changes the, you know, because different crops take and give different things to soil fertility. So I made a trip with our wonderful friend Fred Kirschman of the Leopold Center and Stone Barn Center, and also Fred being one of the early adapters to organic farming, and at one time was the largest organic and biodynamic farmer in the country. So Fred's farm, even though he lives in Ames, is in North Dakota, and his good friend David Vetter's farm is in Nebraska. And apparently the story is that Fred, whose father was farming, you know, and went off the farm and started an academic career in philosophy, that's what his PhD is in, had David Vetter as one of his students. And David told Fred about organic farming in the very, very early days before there was, quote, organic farming. So Fred learned from David, and both of them were kind of early adopters, and also both of them participated in writing the organic federal regulations, which we now kind of all take for granted. But there was a time when we didn't have that legal standard and that codified way of, okay, here's what it takes to become an organic farmer. It is just not willy-nilly. You know, some practices you must do to be certified, and they have to be documented, and they have to be third-party certified. So both David and Fred were very instrumental in setting up this system, which I often describe as the legislation of the organic standards is kind of like a line in the sand. It's because there are now lots of other certifications. You can be, sustainably blah blah, or you can be
green. Green is a good word.
Right. But there's also the non-GMO project, which is a label. There's the American grass-fed standards. Some of these labels are certainly necessary and very legitimate. Some of them are just BS, basically, you know. But the difference with the organic standards is it is a legal standard. None of the other labels have a legal standing behind them, and even though they are often certified and verified and all of that sort of thing. And I would say, given the current regulatory climate, that at least certainly in my lifetime and maybe several other lifetimes, we will never get another legal standard. The organic standard was the first. It is still an improving, evolving standard. You know, there are ways that we change and incorporate new agronomic knowledge that we didn't know about when they were first written more than 20 years ago. And also something that people don't really realize, the writing of the regulations, it was a 10-year process, and it included input from a lot of farmers and of a lot of environmentally concerned and aware. A lot of pioneering effort went into this. It wasn't just like, you know, some little cabal sat down and wrote this out. It was with a lot of public input. It was a very, very unique process. So one of the things that I did do this weekend when I went with Fred to visit David Vetter, there was the first public showing of a new movie called Dreaming of a Vetter World. That's V-E-T-T-E-R, because that's the family name, by a filmmaker from California. She spent 4 years filming at David's farm and at Fred's farm, and kind of talking about the history, and went into a lot of family history too, like when you see the film, you'll see Fred when he was like 30 years younger. It's kind of cute. And David as a young man, and how they did this, both farming with their fathers and making that, you know, doing the research, basically, that started our whole ability to have organic product. So the film, which was shown in Lincoln, Nebraska, will be, hopefully, I have to say, Catherine Dellett, the ISU organic department, basically, agronomy professor, was in the audience, and she hopes to bring it to her organic conference, which is usually, I think, in the fall, and usually at the University of Iowa. So that may be the next possible screening. It's called Dreaming of a Vetter World. And the filmmaker is quite, it's a beautiful film. Oh. It's really, really a beautiful film. And it really clearly talks about, you know, the values and how this whole organic farming thing was started and continues. So, and the other thing that is on David's farm is he, like other organic farmers, and we'll use Earl Hafner as our own Iowa example, when you're growing crops beyond corn, and this is row cropping, okay, or, you know, we live in corn and soybean country. This is good country for growing those kinds of grains and beans. And so organic farmers can't just grow corn and soybeans, and they have to find a market or a way to deal with the products that they're growing in their at least the third year of rotation. Some good farmers around here do many, many more rotations, but the issue in Iowa and Nebraska and Illinois and throughout the Corn Belt is mostly we only have processing anymore for corn and beans. Now, processing means it's not like when you're animal processing and you have to kill it and deal with it. But the processing mostly is, you know, getting it off the, say, the cob or the, you know, you have to clean it, you have to shell it, you have to store it, you have to package it. And I have to say, for example, twice this year I was working with some local product as a chef to make some local foods, like I did it for PFI, and we did a bean dish last January. And of course, I get the beans. I find a farmer in Iowa that's got, you know, I think I had, oh, I don't know, 30 pounds. That's not a small amount in a home kitchen. And sure enough, he shows up. We got him in a couple cardboard boxes, and I take it home, and I look at it, and I go, oh, golly, I have to clean this by hand, right? And so, I spent, let's say, a few days spreading them out on cookie sheets. I do a few at a time, a few cookie sheets worth at a time. You have to pick out the weeds, the rocks, the clods of dirt, the extraneous plant matter that you don't want. And then the same thing happened. I was cooking some wheat berries last month. Same thing. There's little bits of chaff. There's all kinds of stuff in there that you have to pick out by hand. So processing grains is a big deal. And the Vetters process grains. So we toured their plant. It was a little like Willy Wonka, all kinds of interesting machines. So I had a great time in Nebraska.
Oh, very good. And there's this, look for the film. It'll be around Dreaming of a Vetter.
Ooh. Right. When I know of any screenings, we'll be sure to announce it.
Great. Thanks, Donna. Good. Today we talked about mushrooms with Aaron Johnson from Jargrove Farm. And I want to take the opportunity to remind you again that it's blueberry season. Treat yourself to a blueberry road trip. Yes. Go to a you-pick place and enjoy. Fill your buckets. And thanks to Mike for the muffins. Thank you very much there. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. Donalana Kitchen comes on Tuesday at noon and is repeated Tuesday 7 p.m. Support community radio. Oh, I have a cow question here. If a cow laughed hard enough, would milk come out of her nose?
But it might come out of something else.
Oh,
though,
dear. You know. Okay. Oh, my name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had fine engineering by Colin Bursack. Eat good food and enjoy life.